Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hello and welcome to Nothing Concrete, the Barbican podcast. I'm Ben Eshmaid, and on this week's edition, we travel back in our archive and rediscover one of the centre's most ambitious festivals. At a time when musical genres were in flux and people were hungry for something new, the Barbican celebrated Steve Reich with a marathon weekend of music entitled Reverberations. On May the 7th and 8th, 2011, in the Barbican and around the corner in Ellisau, St. Luke's, the venue celebrated the composer's 75th birthday. Reverberations included the European premiere of his string quartet, WTC 911, the UK premiere of his Mallet Quartet by the Amadinda Quartet, and another UK premiere, that of the Pulitzer Prize-winning piece, Double Sextet by 8th Blackbird, and not forgetting the London premiere of 2x5 by Bang on a Can. It was a busy weekend. Looking back in 2020, nearly 10 years after this episode was originally made, we can say now on reflection that the decisions made in regards to the artists to speak to didn't do enough to address diversity across gender. Bearing that in mind, we move back now to 2011. In Reverberations, the influence of Steve Reich, we weave together a tapestry of words, sounds and ideas from some of the artists that travelled from across the world to be part of this weekend. We focus on how they were indebted or influenced by minimalism, including contributions from David Harrington from the Kronos Quartet.
I just thought it would be interesting. I mean, you know, this is his 75th year. Could he write a bookend to different trains? I had no idea what that might mean.
Bryce Desner of Clogs and The National.
You know, the number of kind of like really seminal works where he's, you know, done something that no one had done before is it's kind of shocking.
Owen Pallett.
I would walk 10 miles to see any new piece of Steve.
Tyondi Braxton.
I think history will be very kind to him in the sense of what he's brought to the table.
And of course, Steve Reich himself.
Greater composers than I have died unknown and unloved. Fortunately, there's a large chunk of the musical community, both classical and popular, seems to enjoy it and to think about it. You know, all I can say is I'm very fortunate.
I had to, like, open the blues up and let some of the blues blood come out to show them.
Let's first start with a few other artists who are at the fringes of this series, but whose music has now very much entered the mainstream, starting with composer Max Richter, who first encountered Reich's music via his milkman.
All the kind of my first sort of new music hearing was really via our milkman, who was kind of really into experimental music and was a sort of musician himself. And he used to drop in Philip Glass vinyl and early Reich records and early ECM and stuff with the milk. And so when I was a teenager, I was getting all this amazing new music kind of delivered, which was fantastic. So I came across this stuff really quite early on. Obviously, one of the big influences of Reich had on me personally was that more like as a performer, working in piano circus, you know, I did a lot of performances of his work. It's in the hundreds, I think. A lot of six pianos, the sextet, all the percussion pieces, you know, anything with a keyboard in it, basically. Four organs, we played, you know, just for years and years and years. And so I kind of got to know it really from the inside. And also thinking about, you know, his band and the whole idea of a composer having a band. Obviously, Reich and Glass and these guys were sort of doing this really way back. You know, now that so many composers have their own groups who are playing their own material, it seems kind of an obvious thing to do, but really it was brand new. And the idea of sort of taking your music on the road, it was kind of a revolution.
Now, the sadly passed away Icelandic composer Jóhann Jóhannsson.
One of the first pieces that I heard by Steve Reich was some of the earliest pieces, like Violin Phase and It's Gonna Rain and those sort of tape-based phase pieces. And I remember being really fascinated by those pieces, especially It's Gonna Rain. And one piece in particular had an effect on me, which is four organs. The combination of these shifting patterns, you know, this really hypnotic quality, and the combination of that with the shaker, with this sort of metronomic shaker beat was something really strong for me, and it actually inspired me to start the group Apparat Organ Quartet, which is my kind of side project. So four organs is kind of directly responsible for that. I think it's more apparent in things like Apparat Organ Quartet, for example, than in my solo work, but you can still hear it. I mean, it's kind of like a, you know, it's part of that. I think I'm very much standing on the shoulders of this sort of minimalist, you know, school of music, you know, so it's nice to be a part of this festival in that sense.
And Dusseldorf prepared piano artist Hauschka, aka Volker Bettelmann.
The first time was in 2007 when I was on tour with Moom, with the Icelandic band in America. I had one show by myself in Wesleyan University, which is in Connecticut. And Wesleyan University has a professor teaching there. His name is Elvin Dussier, who's a composer, especially for electroacoustic music, but also he was good friends with John Cage, Steve Reich, Meredith Monk, all these guys that were at the same time doing like a lot of experimental music. And so he was doing a lecture, and I went with my cousin to the lecture of him, and he was playing Steve Reich's Different Drains on this evening, and he was talking about it. And I was really touched because it also was connected with a German history, because one drain is going from Berlin to Auschwitz. And so there was also quite a deeper connection in terms of the historical background of Steve Reich. So I was really in touch with that. The music was very similar to how I feel about music, the repetitive stuff. What I really liked was, especially on Different Drains, because the two drains that are described in this piece has a very deep, more sad meaning, and the other one is more like a happy, not a happy, but a bit different, a different drain, actually. And what I liked about it was the little nuances that he was using for changing actually the whole feeling inside of the piece, and these very slow developments and little changes that actually made everything different. I love that so much. that I straight away fell in love with it. And it was on this tour, I came a couple of times across his compositions, because sometimes the string quartet was opening for us and they were playing actually the full-on different train piece or so. On this whole tour, I was constantly getting in touch with his music, and that's how I actually got in touch with him as a composer. If I want to celebrate my 75th birthday in 25, 30 years, I would love to have a concert or a festival like that. That is not like a whole whatever. People are just talking about my music rather than inviting young talents and whatever. People that are, you know, have all sorts of different angles to contribute, and on the other side, who are connected with my kind of music. That's something that I totally, I think that actually fits perfectly to Steve Reich's music, because the music reflects for me as well very open, an open field, and quite an open mind.
Next, on this edition, we talk to David Harrington, the founder of one, if not the most important ensemble to champion Steve Reich's music, the Kronos Quartet. The quartet premiered his new work, WTC 911, a continuation or a bookend to the ideas started in Different Trains. They performed this alongside work by Scott Johnson, Michael Gordon and Bryce Desner, who we'll hear from later. So I caught up with David Harrington and asked him about the impact Steve Reich's music has had on him and the quartet.
The first piece that I heard of Steve's was Music for 18 Musicians. And that piece just blew me away. I remember when my children were very small playing that frequently in the house, and it was just perfect and wonderful. Eventually, Steve came to San Francisco and he and I met. And at that point, he had not written any string quartet music and didn't really seem interested in writing any. But he said, you know, it'd be cool with him if we wanted to play Vermont Counterpoint, which is the flute piece, and make a version for ourselves. And so I looked at the score, and it just didn't seem like it was a piece for us. But in the meantime, we started playing clapping music. And in fact, we opened a concert in San Francisco with clapping music. And you know that piece, don't you? You know, that rhythm, and then two different pairs of rhythms are going on at the same time. It's a very vibrant piece. So then I wrote a letter to Steve after that and told him we had just played his first string quartet. And so the conversation kind of kept going, and eventually he accepted a commission to write a new piece for Kronos, and that eventually became Different Trains. 1940. I mean, it's hard for me to imagine our concerts and the form that they've taken, and much of the music that has been written for us since 1988, without Different Trains, because it really did totally change, you know, that one piece totally changed how we approached touring, because all of a sudden we found out that we needed to have our own sound engineer. And when composers started hearing what Steve had accomplished in Different Trains, it kind of opened up a huge palette, all sorts of possible colors. And I think that piece has had a big influence on the entire form of the string quartet. You know, when I asked Steve to write another piece, I just thought it would be interesting. I mean, you know, this is his 75th year. Could he write a bookend to Different Trains? I had no idea what that might mean. accept that emotionally it seemed like it would be a fantastic challenge for him, and certainly for Kronos as well. And he accepted the challenge, but it wasn't until many, many months later that I found out what the topic of the piece would be.
More background now from the composer.
It was only because David Harrington of the Kronos Quartet said, you know, we'd like to have you write another piece that uses pre-recorded voices, that I began thinking, well, I had no idea what the voices would be. All I knew was that there were going to be an elongation of the final syllable. Believe it or not, that was the only idea in my head. In other words, if I said to you, he came from Boston, it would be, he came from Boston, and you could hold that indefinitely as a held tone, and then it could be doubled with a viola or a violin, and then the next person would say something, and the last syllable would be prolonged, and you'd start building up these chords connecting people harmonically, as well as through their thoughts and what they said. That was the only idea in my head. I'd had no idea who was talking. It took me 3 or 4 months to finally said, my gosh, I have unfinished business. I've never dealt with 9/11. So then it finally became clear to me. And then I turned, as I always turn, to those who were in the event. By that I mean the traffic controllers who worked for NORAD, who noticed that American 11 was off course and going south when it should have been going west to Los Angeles. The New York City firefighters, who many of whom gave their lives that day, and whose recordings from the fire department are in the first movement. And then recordings that I made myself of friends and neighbors who lived and worked in the area immediately surrounding the Twin Towers, one of which was David Lang, the composer, who says, I was taking my kids to school. So it's a way of working, which I worked in before in different drains and in the cave and in Three Tales, where the people who are involved in a situation can convey the truth of that situation in a way that no one else can. And they can furnish the melodic, the melodies of their voices become the true expression of that event, and I am enabled to be guided in the right direction.
I was taking my kids to school. The first plane went straight over our heads. Went straight over our heads and into the building.
What was the reaction to WTC 9/11 when you performed it earlier this year?
The reaction has been one of, I mean, it's stunning in the sense that you're kind of, you almost can't believe that that you're reliving that day in a concert environment. That's the feeling I get anyway. And so far, we've had 3 performances. It's a major addition to our work. There's not even any question about that.
I've always thought performing Steve Reich's music from an outsider's point of view seems challenging mentally and physically. How have you adapted? How have you approached this over the years?
Well, Steve and I did a talk the other night in North Carolina, and I told him something I don't think I'd ever mentioned before, and that is that every time I play Different Trains, I get this pain in my hand. It's kind of this residual, I don't know what you call it, but it you know, amputees get it. I think it's this pain that somehow your body remembers, and my hand remembers what it felt like to record Different Trains in 1988 with the hours of repetition of that figure in the first movement. And so kind of surmounting that was something that needed to be done first of all. And there is a physical quality to his music. And you know, I was saying to him also that when we play his music in Asia or South America or Europe, Australia, wherever we might be, there is an American quality to his music, and there's also a youthful quality. He's a very youthful 75, by the way, and it's quite unique in music, I would say.
What's the process between you and Steve when composing something such as this new work?
Well, the thing to know about Steve's pieces for Kronos is that we can't perform them until we've recorded them. And so the actual recording that eventually became the CD of Different Trains, for example, was recorded before the world premiere. And the same thing is true of WTC 911. So about, it would have been 2 months ago now, we were in the recording studio in San Francisco recording together. The recording studio becomes part of the composition. I mean, the act of recording is, there were a lot of things that got decided in the recording sessions that had been left kind of up in the air in the composition of the piece, and including a number of the rhythms that we play, because these rhythms are vocal rhythms, and so how to notate them is really, really sometimes very complex, and sometimes it's almost unnotatable, and you have to just figure it out. And there were issues of scoring and the kind of bow stroke that we might use, and dynamics, and so it's kind of like fresco, the final really essential touches are made in the recording session.
You're commissioning new work all the time, searching for new composers, maybe the new Steve Reich, and you've recently worked with Bryce Dessner.
Well, I mean, I'm not looking for the new Steve Reich. I'm looking for individuals who are continually finding their voice in a very potent way. And to me, Bryce Dessner's music is doing that, and the two pieces that he's written for Kronos so far are incredible additions to our work. And Bryce would readily mention Steve Reich's music as an influence. You know, when you hear, for example, Ahim, the first piece that Bryce wrote for Kronos, it has this propulsion and drive. Definitely comes from some of his other influences, as well as Steve's. And more recently, Tenebrae, the newest piece and the one that we will be premiering in London, reaches back to a much earlier time in music, and in fact is influenced by some of the Italian church music. I think Bryce is an amazing musician and someone who is you know, finding new vistas for his work continually.
There you had David Harrington from the Kronos Quartet talking about Reverberations. They also premiered new work by composer and guitarist Bryce Dessner. Bryce is an extremely talented individual who, alongside writing this commission and attending its premiere, will also perform with his ensemble Clogs. And of course, in his spare time, Bryce plays guitar in the band The National. We connect via phone to New York and speak to Bryce Dessner about his musical journey to the festival and the impact and legacy of Steve Reich.
I think I heard Steve Reich's music for the first time, probably in the early 90s. I was into Pat Metheny, actually, and I heard Electric Counterpoint was probably the first piece that I was aware of. And as a guitarist, you know, it's really a major work for the electric guitar and such an incredible piece. So that was my first introduction. And, you know, I ended up studying, you know, composition and guitar in school and in graduate school. So for my generation, you know, the music of Steve Reich has become incredibly important. I think, you know, I've talked to Steve about it, and I think when he was coming up in the 60s, there were very few people who could even play his music, where now that what has become, you know, what at that point was so challenging and kind of radical in terms of his approach has now become really, you know, in a way you could call it part of the canon of, like, you know, music that everyone has to learn. So that's the difference. And I think, you know, I'm definitely part of the generation of people where it's the music of Steve Reich has had tremendous influence.
Is there a particular element that draws you back to his music?
I would say that it's the big, you know, if I had to say that simply, like simply put, I think it's, you know, Steve's use of rhythm is so inventive and so detailed that, you know, for a kind of, for the current era of artists and people who've grown up, you know, largely listening to rock music where, you know, kind of steady tempo and repetitive patterns are part of the language. The number of times he's, you know, the number of kind of like really seminal works where he's, you know, done something that no one had done before. It's kind of shocking the number of influential pieces like that that there are.
And do you think, like yourself, Steve Reich is inspired by New York?
I think the connection there would be that New York is such a cultural capital, and that, and musically, it's such a diverse environment where there's just so many things in the air. And I think that for Steve, whether it would have been like, you know, hearing Moondog or hearing Bebop or hearing Morton Feldman or, you know, it's all these things that were happening in New York. And, you know, for me, it's hearing Steve Reich, or it's hearing all the great bands that are coming out of Brooklyn, or it's hearing, you know, the French gypsy guitarist I heard at a bar last night in Park Slope, or it's hearing You Need Open Ears. And I think that would be what's the kind of, you know, I definitely have talked to Steve Reich a lot about, you know, music and music he's heard. And I think just in general, he's excited about music, you know, and that's something that New York is certainly a great place to be for, you know.
On the subject of New York, let's hear now from Owen Pallett.
I think that there is an attitude in New York that is one of sort of mutual interest and mutual development. In terms of kind of like the crossover between pop music and, you know, so-called highbrow music, I don't think that it's anything new. I think that the advent of the recorded medium kind of made things appear separate for a while, but it's really not the case. Like, I think that all of a sudden that records were created, and then records became something you could sell. Then all of a sudden, you know, there was like all this experimentation going on with like what these records were going to sound like, and sort of like, you know, the look, what a guy looks like, and how he's in this sort of posture of this music. But meanwhile, you know, the modernists were kind of like still really into what was happening in concert music. So anyways, I don't think that there's any real separation. I just think that New York is just a really fertile scene. And that, you know, a large part of that had to do with the composers there in the 60s and 70s, the so-called downtown composers, you know, that Reich was a part of, and really making an effort to kind of separate, you know, the new music scene from being strictly existing in the academic sense, you know what I mean?
You know, for instance, in New York, with certain venues, certain uptown venues, you still get people relating to you like it's 30 or even 40 years ago, you know, where it's kind of forgetting that someone like Steve Reich was even there, in a way where they're saying, oh, well, you're a rock guitar player, but you're right, you know, and it's like, you know, trying to kind of maybe pigeonhole things into being more square or simpler than they are, when actually, like, you know, as Steve puts it, it's like the music is in the air, and it's been in the air for quite some time, and And the boundaries between these things are quite porous, where you have someone like me who's classically trained, you know, where I grew up, you know, playing classical guitar, and I read music well, and I can play chamber music, and I can write a string quartet, and I don't lose sleep over the fact that there's a kind of multiple identity in that. I think Steve Rice is really kind of like, he just bulldozed all those walls. He just said, you know what, we're moving on here. And I think that his music kind of is a rallying point for musicians from all over the place, you know, stylistically. I just found out I run a small festival myself called Music Now every spring, and there's a great band called Megafon that's from Raleigh, North Carolina, that are just incredible singers and musicians, and they... Someone just took a picture of Brad, who's the leader of Megafon's arm, and he has a Steve Reich tattoo on his arm. It's the diagram for how the musicians should be laid out in drumming. And it was a really interesting, just kind of anecdote about how this music is universal, and it's not necessarily about one kind of ghettoized academic corner. So I like to say that new music is often kind of feudal, where you have these sort of like, if you listen to Ty and Dave Braxton's music, who I love, it's wildly creative and extremely different from anything I've done. And I think that's a good sign that actually these things are articulating themselves in diverse ways. And
finally, can you tell me about your involvement and Clogs' involvement over the weekend?
Clogs is performing two concerts. The first one is at St. Luke's on the 7th, and then I'll feature some older works written for the quartet of Clogs, which is, you know, the four of us. So some music off Lantern, which is our fourth record and has... features bassoon and viola, and I'm playing electric guitar, and then there's all different kinds of percussion. We will then on the 8th perform a big selection of songs off the recent record, the Lady Walton record, so that'll feature Shara Warden, who's an amazing singer who's coming over and singing with us. And it also features the New London Children's Choir and four new commissions that we just performed here in Brooklyn with the Brooklyn Youth Chorus, and that will feature a quite a big piece for me called Tori Fell, which is a new piece for Clogs, sort of like an extended ensemble, Clogs plus string quartet, and then the youth choir. So that's you know, those two concerts. And we're, you know, there's also a new suite of songs by Pat Manusum, who's the Australian violist and composer in the band as well. So that's exciting. So there'll be some, you know, music that no one's ever heard before. It's not released in recording. I'm also was commissioned to write a new piece for Kronos Quartet. It's my second string quartet for them, and that'll premiere on the 7th at St. Luke's. And then that evening at the Barbican Hall, they'll be performing my older work as well. So there's two string quartets and then a bunch of stuff in Clogs, and then it's a busy weekend for me.
Next, on this Reverberations edition of the Nothing Concrete podcast, let's spend some more time with violinist, singer and composer Owen Pallett. Owen has won a massive fan base, firstly recording music under the name Final Fantasy, with his fame and acclaim spreading through his collaborations with bands such as Arcade Fire, Beirut and Grizzly Bear. Near the time of the concert series, he released his album Homeland under his own name, and Reverberations would have allowed you the rare opportunity to hear a performance of the album in full, with most importantly, the addition of an orchestra, the London Sinfonietta. To Canada to speak to Owen Pallett, who I found was very excited to be part of this festival.
Absolutely, yeah. It's a real honor. I'm really excited to be playing with the London Sinfonietta in the Barbican space. I mean, I've been to see quite a few concerts there in the few times that I've been in London, you know. So it's exciting. But I get excited with the opportunity to play with any sort of orchestra, you know. It's really a privilege for me.
Cross her off the short list. My blood is a red-winged bird.
I was reading your father was an organist. Was music always there? Was it always going to be the path for you?
Much for my child in my childhood, yeah. I kind of developed a real, you know, a real cynical sort of side, and also a sense of kind of moral duty when I was a teen, and decided that I would have much preferred to, you know, go into a profession that I thought was honorable, like, you know, medicine, for example. And it was really kind of at the last minute when I was applying to university. I was like, oh, I think maybe I'll do music composition, because it seems to me that there's like a lot of people out there that, you know, are better than me at chemistry, but, you know, I'm pretty good at like parsing chords and doing that kind of stuff. So I went to composition school with that, like no idea with what I was going to do with it, aside from the fact that, you know, I theoretically might enjoy writing an opera. And I'm still wrestling with it every day, so I'm just kind of like, really, music, huh? I feel like there's so many more worthwhile things you can do with one's life. But
have you had the chance to perform Homeland with an orchestra before?
Not in its complete format. I've kind of done, you know, certain songs just like fit really well, but then there's other songs on the record that are long or really rhythmically complicated that I haven't really had the guts to kind of actually try and do with a bunch of musicians. So, you know, I've been working to get a band together for it, because I kind of need to have like some of the musicians who are really, really familiar with the songs to really kind of pull it off.
Could you talk about the themes and stories which run through the album?
There is a narrative, yeah, but I've really made an effort to kind of downplay it, you know, like right from the very beginning when the record came out, I was like, I don't want to actually talk about it, just because I feel that it kind of explains itself just in the listening to the record.
And would you like to do more in the future with orchestras after a project such as this?
No, playing with an orchestra is too stressful, sort of like a real one-off thing. I get offers sometimes and it's just completely, it's going to make my hair fall out. I do like I'm otherwise playing the songs using Maximus P and doing kind of like this multiphonic looping. It's a pretty involved performance process that, you know, I've kind of had to actually spend like kind of the last year and a half really adjusting to, you know, what is required of me as a performer. And just in the last year, I feel like it's been really kind of working extremely well. So having this suddenly kind of work with an orchestra is, you know, it's a tall order.
I will seek out my own satisfaction, from the white lion in the barrow to the priest with his broken arrows. There's a method to the madness. They will feign an expression of sadness, a concatenation of love. I will sing, sing, sing to the masses. Oh, heartland up yours.
And are you looking forward to any other performance at Reverberations?
Well, I'm really, really excited about the Reich works that are on my program, but I'm actually extremely, extremely huge fan of Julia Wolf, and I'm really excited that I'm going to be able to see her work. It's actually on the same program as me, which is really convenient. But I mean, and of course, like I would walk 10 miles to see any new piece of Steve. So it's really wonderful that I'm going to be able to maybe just walk half to see it.
Thanks to Owen for speaking to us. Just one more interview before we get round to speaking to the composer whose music powers the festival, Steve Reich himself. But first, I speak to Tyondai Braxton, the guitarist and singer who began his career with the Warp Sign band Battles. Alongside many of the people we have spoken to, he really does show that the world of rock and classical have now blurred and changed beyond all recognition. He performed his solo album Central Market together with the BBC Symphony Orchestra, conducted by André Derrida. Let's start with if he remembers the first time he heard Reich's music.
Well, you know, I can't remember exactly like when exactly, but it was when I was really, really young. You know, my father's a composer, and I would often hear when I was really young a lot of Steve Reich's music being played throughout the house, you know. So there, you know, I'd like wake up in the morning, my father would be listening to music, and, you know, I'd wake up to like some kind of pulse happening, you know, downstairs in the living room. So it was in a weird way, it was kind of just like a part of the fabric of my early life in a lot of ways. And, you know, as I've grown up, you kind of start to see different shades of what his music has been. So I've been kind of lucky in that I've been able to see all these different shades, since being that I've started listening to his music so young, or was aware of his music when I was really young.
Tayondai, it may be obvious, but was your father a big influence on you?
Yeah, you know, it's always inspiring to see someone have, you know, a deep passion and a deep enthusiasm about something. And when that person is also your father, you know, you're suddenly in this environment where you have your blood relative showing you that life could be lived in this kind of way, and that look how exciting all these things are, you know. So I really took to that, and you know, it's like everyone's inspired by their parents in some way, shape, or form, I would imagine. When you multiply that times the fact that your father's actually doing, you know, this huge transformative kind of work in the arts, he made it seem really exciting and really inviting. So it allowed me to explore my own.
I think it's fair to say rhythm or the sense of pulse seems to be important in your work and was with the band Battles.
Yeah, I mean, well, in the sense that it's very loop-based. You know, when I was in, like, high school and college, I was in a bunch of rock bands and a bunch of kind of, like, really ambitious kind of progressive bands, you know, that might have been more ambitious than we were actually good, you know? But at the same time, I really appreciated the camaraderie between, you know, me and the people that I was playing with. When those bands ended, I realized how fragile a band is, and I really wanted to find a way to be able to generate music myself and be able to, you know, continue on with my own work without having to rely on people. So I kind of stumbled upon, I bought a digital delay pedal, and I realized that if you have the feedback knob turned all the way up, it could kind of repeat almost indefinitely. And yeah, so I started to kind of find myself in repetition and in loops, and I, you know, it was happenstance on one side of the spectrum. On the other side, it really did feed into my love for a pulse and some kind of rhythmic generation. And it also allowed me to, once I laid down some like a part or so, I'd have to kind of come up with some kind of instant counterpoint. I'd have to start thinking what kind of harmonic character can come to it. So in that way, I did start to look to guys like Reich and guys like my dad and guys like John Adams, and David Torn, Robert Fripp, stuff like that. And so I slowly started to kind of hone in on that, on that way of working.
Is it fair to say, from your perspective, the lines between rock, prog rock, and contemporary classical are now feel not there or blurred?
Well, you know, I feel like I don't have the perspective yet to say what I've blurred together. I think other composers would agree with this when I say that the kind of music that I write is just a product of my interests. And, you know, I don't just listen to classical music or just rock music or just this or that. You know, I'm open to absorbing all different types of music. And, you know, over my 32 years, I've had my obsessions with this and that and the other thing. So I hear those things that I've gone through in the music. And, you know, those qualities are there of rock music, of classical music, of course. And specifically, are those the main ingredients? I don't know. I guess I don't see it that way, but I guess I can't argue if people say that they do.
So with this solo album, you've had the opportunity to work with an orchestra. What was that like?
Yeah, well, it's the second solo record I've done, but it's the first of its kind. I never actually went out and did a full-on kind of orchestra piece as a record. And yeah, I'm going to have that performed. I think we're going to do every piece on the record except kind of the more song-like piece called Jay City. I think every other piece we're going to do. And yeah, it's really, really exciting. You know, we just had we premiered it here in the States with the Wordless Music Orchestra and a core group of musicians, myself. And it went really well. And so I'm really, really thrilled to be able to bring it to the UK, especially in the context of a festival like this. And with the BBC Symphony Orchestra, it's a huge honor to be able to work with a group like that.
So lastly, back to Steve Reich, and what do you think about the legacy of the music he's written so far?
When you're talking about Steve Reich, you know, he's going to go down, I mean, he's already gone down in history as one of the most important composers that our craft has been lucky enough to have, and he really is a special kind of composer, and I think history will be very kind to him in the sense of what he's brought to the table. So he's a real master, you know, he's a master composer. So how do you talk about a master composer? I think people recognize his contribution to his craft.
And now we come to the final interview of the podcast, and we felt very privileged to have time to speak to the composer of Clapping Music, It's Gonna Rain, Come Out, Different Trains, Music for 18 Musicians, The Desert Music, Electric Counterpoint, You Are Variations, amongst many more. One of the most influential composers in what became described as minimalism. But to start with, who inspired Steve Reich?
Well, I think when I first heard The Rite of Spring by Igor Stravinsky at the age of 14, I think that really was the decisive factor in my wanting to become a composer. That such a work was possible, that such a musical language existed that I was completely unaware of at the time, if I had to pick one moment in time and say, you know, that's when I wanted to become a composer, that was the moment, and that was the piece, and that was the composer. Stravinsky, I think, said that the only one who really understood the piece was Maurice Ravel, who said it's the musical organism. It's not just the rhythm. It's not just the harmonies. It's not just the dissonance. It's not just the tunes that are in there, although they are mostly, many of them, folk tunes, which Stravinsky denied, but of course they are, in fact, folk tunes. It's the whole work. I mean, the rhythmic part of it, of course, is what's talked about the most, and of course that did have a big impact on me. But it's just the energy, this organism that exists, which is unlike anything which preceded it. Is well-known fact in musical life and musical history, and it just hit me when I was young at 14 and very impressionable and made an enormous impression.
And at an early age, you went from learning the piano to the drums. What drew you from one to the other?
Well, I was, again, this was at 14, and shortly after I heard the Stravinsky, I heard bebop. I heard, but I also heard Johann Sebastian Bach for the first time, but I heard Charlie Parker, Miles Davis, and the drummer Kenny Clarke, and I had a friend who was studying jazz piano. He was way better than I was, and he said, well, we ought to start a band. I said, I'm the drummer. And I began studying with Roland Koloff, K-O-H-L-O-F-F, who was then the local great drummer and who went on to become the timpanist with the New York Philharmonic. So that's at the age of 14, I not only started listening to a whole bunch of new music, but I started studying percussion formally. And so that was a very important year in my musical development.
And I believe you as a performer were involved in playing your own music for a long period of time.
Yes, I was involved in playing my own music with my own ensemble from 1966 to 2006. That's 40 years. And I still am involved as a guest performer. I played clapping music last week in Amsterdam, and I will join the Ensemble Moderne to play music for 18 musicians in a number of European locations, including Bonn and Düsseldorf and Krakow, Poland, amongst others. Oh, and excuse me, at the Proms as well.
Is it important or interesting to play the music from the sort of inside?
Well, I think most of the composers that we, quote, know and love were involved in the performance of their own music in some way, shape, or form. Stravinsky was a conductor, Bartok was a pianist, Charles Ives was an organist, and a lot of those organ tunes find their way into his music. Aaron Copland was the conductor, John Adams is a conductor, Phil Glass played in his own ensemble, Terry Riley's played in his own ensemble. I think that this is generally a healthy sign when you're involved in the practical side of it, because you learn things from the performance of music that you can only learn that way, and which are stand you in very good stead in a practical sense. And basically, good composers are very practical musicians.
Was it hard to find musicians to play your music, as it's quite challenging musically?
I had no problem finding musicians for my own ensemble. One good musician led to another, and as I said, by 1966 I had a trio, by 1967 I had a quintet, and in 1970 I had the 12 musicians playing drumming and singing as well, because one good player just leads to another. What you may be referring to is the fact that up through, I would say, the middle 80s, I was very reticent about having other groups outside of my own play my own music, because I felt that at that time, as you may or may not remember, music was dominated by the aesthetic of Boulez, Stockhausen, Berio, and Cage, where you had no regular beat, no regular rhythm, no melody of any normal recognizable sort, no harmony of any recognizable sort. And my music relied on all of those. And a lot of people who were involved in that aesthetic looked at me as a lunatic. I knew that if I entrusted my music to their performance, it would be butchered. So I was held back. Fortunately, by the time, one of your countrymen, Bill Colleran, who's no longer with us, took a shine to my music and wanted to publish it for Universal Edition London, and it did publish about five or six of my really early pieces back in the early 1980s. And then by 1987, I could sense there was really a larger community of people who were going to do very good performances of my music, and that's when I began working with Boosie and Hawks, and that was one of the best decisions I ever made in my whole life. It's been a wonderful working relationship with Boosie, and through them, my music is played all over the world. You can go to my website or their website, and you can see hundreds of performances happening each year to people that I've never heard of. I mean, some of which I've heard of, but most of which I haven't heard of. And that's wonderful news. I mean, every composer wants to be played. That's why you write the music. To see that happening, and happening a lot, is extremely gratifying.
And when were you aware that your music was traveling across the globe to such a big audience?
Well, it's all been very gradual. So it's perseverance, and also, I mean, I guess I've written by now a number of pieces that are quite different from one another. And then for different kinds of ensembles, there's a lot of vocal music, a lot of instrumental music, some music which still uses pre-recorded electronic material, collaborations with Beryl Carr that are my contributions to musical theater. And so obviously there are still people who are not particularly fond of what I do, but fortunately, there's a large chunk of the musical community, both classical and popular, which is really, really seems to enjoy it and to think about it. All I can say is I'm very fortunate. Greater composers than I have died completely. Béla Bartók died unknown and unloved. I mean, he was a musician's musician, and immediately after his death, with the concerto for orchestra, there was a Bartók craze, and he became a regular staple of the literature. But it didn't happen in his lifetime. It varies enormously from case to case. Stravinsky was a success all his life, so every composer's career or success or failure is quite an individual case.
And given the chance, is composition a daily ritual for you still?
It's a daily thing, unless other things are in the way. Right now, this year is a very busy year of travel because of the turning 75, and because of the kind of conversation you and I are having. I mean, shortly after you and I talked to somebody coming from the London Times here, this year, as it was in 2006 when I was 70, there is more concert activity than usual, and more travel for me personally, which takes away from the time available to compose. But normally, I would be composing most afternoons and evenings. I'm a 12 noon to 12 midnight composer. I'm not a morning type. I have music notebooks that I've worked on since I started composing, and I still use them. But I also use the computer, and I use the piano. And between the notebooks and the computer and the piano, it gets written.
And some final words and thoughts from David Harrington from Kronos Quartet.
Well, I think it's, his music has influenced musicians in many genres and in many different configurations of instruments and voices, and I think it's fantastic to have a festival that brings some of these musicians together and celebrates the influence of Steve's work and in some cases. I know one of the programs that we're going to do, that there are a couple of pieces that we'll be playing that also demonstrate some of the influences on Steve and Steve's work. And so there's nobody in the world that hasn't been influenced by someone else. So it's, that kind of fabric of influence and sound and approach is really a beautiful thing to think about and learn from, I think.
It's gonna rain after all, before the days and before the night. And the people didn't believe him, and they began to laugh at him, and they began to mock him, and they began to say, it ain't gonna rain!
And placed him in the Garden of Eden to serve it and to keep it.
The process is as follows.
I hope you've enjoyed this special Reverberations archive edition of Nothing Concrete. Bresch is a composer's composer, as it's clear from the interviews you've just heard. And to be able to hear these albums and works brought together on the Barbican stage was, at the time, extremely special. It was a crazy few days of impossible logistics and ambitious performance. My thanks to Oliver Scherer for some extra production on the title jingle. I'm Ben Eshmade. You're listening to an archive edition of Nothing Concrete, the Barbican podcast. It's here to inspire more people to discover and love the arts with weekly episodes of archive finds and theme series. Subscribe to Nothing Concrete on Acast, Spotify, or wherever you find your podcasts. And if you can, leave us a review to help us get the word out.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.